Well, welcome everybody to the Marxist School of Sacramento. Thanks very much for coming out tonight, supporting us. We're nothing without you. You know, where there's a will, put the Marxist School in. Okay. Housekeeping, to your right are the restrooms. We'll be breaking at 8 p.m. for fundraising, refreshments, etc., followed by a question and answer with our speaker tonight, Donald Nicholson Smith, who translated this book, The Revolution of Everyday Life. It was born from an art movement of artists in France during the 1960s, and have I forgotten anything, Ellen?
Yes,
oh, yes, your cell phones. Your dreaded cell phones.
Your body makes one voice. That's the
Revolution of Everyday Life is available tonight. To my right, your left, from Ramsey Cannon, head of PM Press. So without any further ado, let us welcome Donald Nicholson Smith.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I've just finished publishing this book with Ramsey, whom you all know, and he's done a wonderful job, and I'm very happy with it. And I hope a few of you will buy a copy and see if you're interested in what I have to say. Perhaps you'll be interested enough to buy it, to take a look at it. I'm assuming not much knowledge on the part of you all, because I'm going to be talking about France in the 19. I'm going to try and keep my stay close to the mic, if I can. I don't know if we really need the mic, but I do have it. Is that better? Or if I speak into the mic, better. Okay. I'm going to talk about the run-up to 1968 in France, when, of course, it seemed to be a very quiet time politically. There was the Algerian War, which was not quiet, but generally it was a very politically, not much seemed to be happening in a way. But there was a lot of infighting amongst the parties, and there was a lot of the Marxist intelligentsia, notably, who were very divided over many things. And to the left of them, you had a lot of small groups of what would be described as Trotskyist or otherwise neo-Bolshevik groups who were not Communist Party. And that was the general context in which a lot of discussion happened amongst the intellectuals. I don't think anybody really foresaw May 1968 and the events of that year in France. The group that produced this book was the Situationist International, who were originally an anti-art group, or an avant-garde group of artists or former artists, who were of course way on the left politically, but who only gradually became more and more political and included in their activities and their thinking a critique of the left, as well as an allegiance to a revolutionary program of their own, which was essentially anti-Stalinist in the way in which they would have described it at the time. And this group, by the time 68 came along, were very influential amongst the students and the workers of that moment, which was really a revolutionary moment. Obviously, it failed to make a revolution, but it was a revolutionary moment, I think, without any question, in May and June of 1968. So this particular book should be remembered that it was written in 1965 and 1966, and it was then 20 years after the liberation of France, and the context was young people who were very rebellious and artists who were very rebellious as well. So, and the author, Raoul Vanighem, was one member of this group. And he and Guy Debord, who was another member of the group, decided that the group needed to have a book or books, as well as just a journal, which they published a journal over several years. They wanted to have books which would be somehow would express their worldview, I would say. I mean, they weren't, it wasn't truly programmatic statements. It wasn't a program, although there were elements of that in these books. But the two men both wrote their own book without consulting each other. So really, even though this is the product of a group, a revolutionary group from the 1960s, it's also the product of one author, one member of the group. It's not a collective work. And his name is Raoul Van Egem, and he was Belgian, or still is a Belgian, because he continues to write very, very, he writes continually, I should say. And he continues to have a very radical critique of modern society, especially in its aspects of what was called the society of the spectacle. I hope I'm not losing you, I'm trying to just give the general, very general context. And I'm going to start by reading not directly from the 1965 text, but from an introduction written a year or so ago, which tries to present the American or the English edition, New English edition, which is this. So I think it would be handy if I read a little bit from the introduction, which sort of says where the author is now and, you know, basically presents the book itself in its context. So let me read, this is the author's preface to the present edition, like 2000, whatever year we're in now, 13, right? The years go by rather quickly. Long known as the New World, the United States of America is now viewed by Europeans as a paradoxically archaic country. Its technological achievements would warrant only admiration were they not belied by a mental stagnation that allows the icy waters of egotistical calculation to preside over an inhumanity cynically defended in the name of profit. I am not speaking of the Americans themselves. It takes a repellent contempt and stupidity to place what are unique individuals under the abstract rubric of a national identity, no matter how prone those individuals may be to relinquishing their creative powers and embracing mass conformity. What I have in mind, rather, is the dismal succession of American administrations, all brought to power by plain old graft, which in their ever more risible arrogance care nothing for growing immiseration, know nothing of social solidarity, degrade the environment, destroy the earth for financial gain, and, armed with an ignominiously clear conscience, promote a Calvinism that treats financial success as a divine dispensation. Of course, the Europeans, no less arrogant, have a grand old time pointing the finger at these would-be paragons of formal democracy who practice capital punishment, embrace the idiotic fad for creationism, tolerate a woefully inadequate social safety net that scorns workers' rights and skimps on unemployment benefits and pensions, and cede immense power to the military and to barbarity, in which last department they are indeed champions. But so-called left-wing public opinion in France, as fond as it is of draping itself in the robes of the revolution of 1789, even of the Paris Commune, and to citing those events as object lessons for others, has not only fallen over the years for every conceivable false vision of emancipation, liberalism, socialism, Stalinism, Trotskyism, Maoism, and Castroism, for example, but offers not the slightest objection to the reversal of progressive social gains, the slashing of social security and cultural budgets, the dismemberment of healthcare system, the reduction of education to a form of battery farming, and in general, the growing impoverishment of existence. Source of the despair from which the managers of economic collapse wring their last profits. Ever since consumerism spread patronage everywhere and harnessed the lies of ideology to the needs of merchandising, the free-for-all of market democracy has obliterated any consciousness of the need to fight exploitation. The crimes committed in the names of the liberation of the proletariat have helped in no small measure to spread a spirit of apathy and fatalism highly conducive to that suicidal impulse which, with or without religious buttressing, works for a universal and apocalyptic death. The plunder of existential and terrestrial resources carried on with impunity by state and private mafias fuels a creeping dread, a state of funk that is absurd inasmuch as Europeans, at least, no longer need to fear tanks in the streets or brutal and systematic police intrusion. The internalized terror is quite simply a fear of living, of autonomy, of self-creation. But no matter how exhausted the life forces grow, a moment always comes when consciousness rouses itself, reasserting its rights and retrieving its outgoing exuberance. I have always wagered on a reversal of perspective, which, raising a past dominated by contempt for human beings, will usher in a new society founded on the creative capacities of individuals and on an irrepressible desire to revel in oneself and in the world. We are in the midst of a civilizational shift, one that the occupations movement of May 1968 in France illuminated in that it strove to accelerate it, thus hastening the collapse of consumer society and the emergence of a society committed to life. Just as the agrarian economy of the Ancien Régime was an atrophied formation, fated, thanks to the revolution of 1789, to be swept away by the surging free market system, so the investment-driven and speculative capitalism whose crisis we are now witnessing is about to give way to a newly dynamic form driven by the production of green, so-called, non-polluting kinds of energy, by an appeal to use value, by organic farming, by a hurried makeover of the public sector, and by a spurious ethical reform of trade. We are confronted not by an economic crisis, but by a crisis of the economy as such. Strife rages between two forces within the capitalist system, the one moribund, the other still young. On the one hand, a system dating back thousands of years, whose basis is the exploitation of nature and of human beings. On the other, a rejigged version, seeking to establish itself by investing in natural forces and making us pay very dear, once new means of production have been put in place, for things hitherto free, wind, sun, water, and the energy that resides in the plant world and in the earth itself. This book, The Revolution of Everyday Life, made, and he's referring to the original edition in 1967, made no prophecies. It merely pointed out what many people, blinded by the past, refused to see. It sought to show how the will to emancipation, reborn with each succeeding generation, might take advantage of the seismic or seismic convulsions which under the impact of consumerism were shaking a supposedly eternal authoritarian power to its very foundations. And it demonstrated the irreversibility of the break with patriarchal values, with work, with the exploitation of nature, exchange, predatory relationships, separation from the self, sacrifice, guilt, the renunciation of happiness, the fetishism of money and power, hierarchical authority, contempt for and fear of women, the corruption of childhood, intellectual pedigrees, military and police despotism, religion, ideology and repression, and lethal ways of relieving repression. By counting on the inevitable disintegration of the patriarchal order, this book was able to embody a commitment to life, which, co-optation notwithstanding, has now become commonplace. Women, children, animals, nature, desire, and the quest for happiness and gratification, freed from fear and guilt, all now enjoy a status granted them never before in history. But the most radical part of my wager was confidence in the vital force that spreads surreptitiously from one individual to the next when the consciousness of the wish to live and of its possible fulfillment stymies the death reflex, which is its reverse, and when, throwing despair itself into despair, one finds oneself to be a human being capable of constructing one's own happiness while at the same time nourishing that of others. It is my belief, despite all the dilly-dallying, as the barbarism of old continues, thanks to inertia, to tyrannize over the present, that a new society is being built in secret, that genuinely human relationships are coming into being, without replying to oppressive violence by a like violence, albeit directed at the oppressor. Relationships able to create zones of freedom where existence can free itself from the diktats of the commodity, banishing competition in the name of emulation, and banishing work in the name of creativity. So this was pretty much, these remarks were made a year ago. So that's how he sees this book a little bit now, with almost 50 years of hindsight. And so you can see that Van Agem is in one way very, very optimistic, but he has such a radical critique of the present arrangement of society that he also has clearly a very, very pessimistic analysis. And the two things are, throughout the book, these two attitudes are maintained in a sort of unresolved contradiction, I think corresponding to the nature of our experience the modern world. Those were introductory remarks made just a short time ago. So now I'm going to read from a chapter of the book, which has the flavour of the time when this was originally written, which was in many ways a sort of pre-revolutionary atmosphere in France.
Can I just interrupt you?
Yes, please.
I don't know anything about this book.
Yes.
And so, this is actually, I'd like to know what the structure of the book is and what its intent is, just kind of an outline. If you could give us that for maybe
okay.
a few minutes before you do any more reading, because I'm not sure where we're headed with this.
Well, I can only read you an extract, but as far as the structure of the book is concerned, it's a little bit idiosyncratic. It's just his own personal beliefs regarding the world in which he finds himself. But his background, the author's background, is a town in Belgium, Lessines, where there were... with a very, very strong working class tradition of rebellion and class struggle, and also a certain number of artists. Magritte was one of them, a surrealist painter. And so his background was at once sort of, he was a working class origin, and his background, but of course he got a good education and went to university and so forth, and became an intellectual, but something of a maverick intellectual, because he never remained in any institutional context. He left, I think he did teach briefly as a young man, but he wasn't able to stay within an academic institution. And so he was a sort of he wasn't an autodidact, but he was definitely an intellectual. And in the early 60s, he joined this movement, which I mentioned before, the Situations International, and became a leading light in that movement for 10 or 12 years. And his book is, in a sense, a kind of a statement of a general position regarding society, as I say, two somewhat contradictory feelings, one positive or optimistic, and one of them obviously much less so. I can't really... the structure of the book, I don't know how really to define it. It's just a philosophical book, it has two parts, and one part is like gives the sort of... It's a description of the everything, the conditions under which we live, and the second part tries to envisage how this situation could be transcended. I mean, very simply, that's the outline of the book. But it's a longish book. I mean, it's, some... 300 pages, so that if I read to you from one chapter, it really is only one chapter. Only one chapter. It doesn't can't cover all the different sort of topics that he covers. I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't know if I can do much better than that. And I would like to read a bit more of the chapter called Sacrifice, which I think is interesting. I mean, much would be very interesting.
Can you tell us who wrote the foreword?
what I just read?
Yes.
The author.
Who?
The author.
Oh, okay.
So it was his own. It was his own remarks concerning the fact that we were going to have a new English language edition. Okay. So what you heard was his voice, not mine or anybody else. But it just happens to be written about the present day rather than, you know, something almost 50 years ago. And what I'm going to read now is like a call to arms, you know, from 65 in a way. And the whole book is a call to arms in many ways. Although there's a very, you know, sort of, there's a very complicated relationship to the question of revolutionary violence, which in one way he welcomes as long as it's spontaneous. And the question is totally opposed to terrorism as a very bad idea. So these were conversations that were going on in the 60s and continued, you know, through the 70s, obviously. So that was, you know, but this, we're really talking about 1966, when, with what you're just about to hear. He's not really describing well, I'll just let him speak for himself, I think. So this chapter is called Sacrifice. And please do interrupt me. I have no problem with anybody interrupting if they have a question. Where people are not broken and broken in by force and fraud, they are seduced. As a means of seduction, power deploys internalized constraints based on lies and cloaked in a clear conscience, the masochism of the model citizen. To this end, castration had perforce to be called selfishness, selflessness, and a choice of servitudes had to be called freedom. The feeling of having done one's duty makes everyone into their own honourable executioner. As I have showed elsewhere, the master-slave dialectic implies that the mythical sacrifice of the master subsumes the real sacrifice of the slave. Masters make a spiritual sacrifice of their real power to the general interest, while slaves make a material sacrifice of their real life to a power of which they partake in appearance only. The framework of generalized appearances, or if you prefer, the essential lie required initially for the development of privative appropriation, which is the appropriation of things by means of the appropriation of beings, is an intrinsic aspect of the dialectic of sacrifice and the root of the notorious separation that it entails. The mistake of the philosophers was that they built an ontology and the notion of an unchanging human nature on the basis of a mere social accident, a purely contingent necessity. History has been seeking to eliminate privative appropriation ever since the conditions which called for it ceased to exist. But the metaphysical maintenance of the philosopher's error continues to work to the advantage of the masters of society, the so-called eternal ruling minority. The misfortune of sacrifice is inseparable from that of myth. Bourgeois thought exposes the materiality of myth, deconsecrating and fragmenting it. It does not abolish it, however, for otherwise the bourgeoisie would cease to exploit and hence to exist. The fragmentary spectacle is simply one phase in the disintegration of myth, a process accelerated today by the dictatorship of the consumable. Similarly, the old sacrifice gift, ordained by cosmic forces, has shriveled into a sacrifice exchange, minutely metered in terms of social security and social democratic justice. And sacrifice attracts fewer and fewer devotees, just as fewer and fewer people are seduced by the miserable show put on by ideologies. The fact is that today's tiny private masturbations are a feeble replacement indeed for the orgiastic heights offered by eternal salvation of the period before the Bourgeois Revolution. How could hoping for a promotion conceivably vie with the wild dream of life everlasting? Our only gods are heroes of the fatherland, heroes of the shop floor, heroes of the frigidaire, Heroes of fragmented thought, how are the mighty fallen? Nevertheless, the knowledge that an ill's end is in sight is called comfort when you still have to suffer it in the present moment. And the praises of sacrifice are still sung on every side. The air is filled with the sermonizing of red priests and ecumenical bureaucrats, vodka mixed with holy water. Instead of a knife between our teeth, we have the drool of Jesus Christ on our lips. Sacrifice yourselves joyfully, brothers and sisters, for the cause, for order, for the party, for unity, or for meat and potatoes. The old socialists were wont to say, "You think you are dying for your country, but really you are dying for capital." Today, their errors are berated in similar terms. You think you're fighting for the proletariat, but really you die for your leaders. You are not building for the future. Men and steel are the same thing in the eyes of the five-year plan. And yet, what do today's young Turks of the left do after chanting such slogans? They enter the service of a cause, the best of all causes, they think. The time that they have for creative activity, they squander handing out leaflets, sticking up posters, demonstrating or heckling local politicians. They become militants, fetishizing action because others are doing their thinking for them. Sacrifice has an endless succession of tricks up its sleeve. The finest cause is one in which individuals can lose themselves, body and soul. The principles of death are just the denial of the principles of the will to live. But either death or life must prevail. There is no middle way, no possibility of compromise between them on the level of consciousness. One must be entirely for the one or entirely for the other. The fevered supporters of an absolute order, be they Nazis or Carlists, have always shown with unwavering consistency that they are on the side of death. As a party line, the slogan "Viva la muerte" could hardly be clearer. By contrast, our reformists of death in small doses, our ennui-promoting socialists, cannot even claim the dubious honour of an aesthetic of total destruction. All they can do is mitigate the passion for life, stunting it to the point where it turns against itself and changes into a passion for destruction and self-destruction. They oppose concentration camps, but only in the name of moderation, moderate power, and moderate death. Great scorners of of life that they are, the partisans of absolute self-sacrifice to state, cause, or Führer do have one thing in common with those whose passion for life challenges the ethos and techniques of renunciation. Though antithetical, their sense of jubilation is equally acute. For them, it is as though life, being so festive in its essence, but tormented by a monstrous asceticism, resolves to end it all by distilling all the splendor of which it has been robbed into a single instant. Legions of Puritans, mercenaries, fanatics, death squads, all experience a moment of bliss as they die. But this is a fait macabre, frozen, caught for eternity in a camera flash, aestheticized. The paratroopers that Marcel Bijard speaks of leave this world through the portal of aesthetics. The paratroopers were those sent to Algeria by the French. They are statue-like figures, mineralized, conscious perhaps of their ultimate hysteria. For aesthetics is carnival paralyzed, petrified, as cut off from life as a Hebrew head, the feast of death. The aesthetic element here, moreover, the element of pose, corresponds to the element of death secreted by everyday life. Every apocalypse is beautiful, but this beauty is dead. Remember the song of the Swiss Guard that Louis Ferdinand Céline taught us to love. The end of the Commune was no apocalypse. The difference between the Nazis dreaming of bringing the world down with them and the Communards of Paris leaving the city to the flames is the difference between total death brutally affirmed and total life brutally denied. The Nazis merely activated a mechanism of logical annihilation already set up by humanists preaching submission and abnegation. The communards knew that a life once constructed with passion cannot be reduced piece by piece, that there is more satisfaction in destroying such a life in seeing it mutilated, and that it is better to go up in flames with a glad heart than to give an inch, when giving an inch is the same thing as complete surrender. Better die on our feet than live on our knees. Despite its repulsive source, the lips of the Stalinist Ibaruri, it seems to me that this cry eloquently expresses the legitimacy of a particular form of suicide, a good way of taking leave. And what was right for the communist holds good for individuals. Oh, sorry, that's a mistake. And what was right for the commune holds good for individuals. Let us have no more suicide from weariness, which comes like a final sacrifice, crowning all those that have gone before. Better one last laugh, a la Craven, or one last song, a la Ravachon. And I'll read a little bit more. I don't want to. I'll just read a little bit more, if that's okay. Revolution ceases to exist from the moment one must sacrifice oneself for it. I think that's the central idea of this chapter, actually. So I just say, revolution ceases to exist from the moment one must sacrifice oneself for it. From the moment one must lose oneself in it and fetishize it. Revolutionary moments are carnivals in which the individual life celebrates its unification with a regenerated society. The call for sacrifice in such a context is a death knell. Jules Vallès was unworthy of himself when he wrote, "So long as the submissive live no longer than the rebellious, one might as well rebel in the name of an idea." For a militant can only be revolutionary in spite of the ideas he's agreed to serve. The real Vallès was the Vallès who fought for the commune, the sometime child, sometime student, making up in one long Sunday for the endless weeks of his past. Ideology is the rebel's tombstone. Its purpose is to prevent his coming back to life. When rebels start believing that they are fighting for a higher good, the authoritarian principle is bolstered. Humanity has never been short of justifications for giving up the human. In fact, some people possess a veritable reflex of submission, an irrational terror of freedom. And this masochism is everywhere visible in everyday life. With what galling ease we give up a wish, a passion, the most essential part of ourselves. With what passivity, what inertia, we accept living or acting for something, or rather something, a word whose dead weight seems to prevail everywhere. It is hard to be oneself, so we give up readily, seizing on whatever pretext we can. Love of children, of reading, of artichokes, you name it. The wish for a remedy evaporates in face of the abstract generality of the ill. And yet the impulse to freedom also knows how to make use of pretexts. Even a strike for higher wages or a riot in the streets can awaken the carnival spirit. As I write, thousands of workers around the world are downing tools or picking up guns, ostensibly in obedience to directives or principles, but actually, at the profoundest level, in response to their passionate desire to change their lives. The unstated agenda of every insurrectionary movement is the transformation of the world and the reinvention of life. No theorist formulates these demands, rather they are the sole foundation of poetic creativity. Revolution is made every day despite and indeed in opposition to the specialists of revolution. This revolution is nameless, like everything that springs from lived experience. Its explosive integrity is forged continuously in the everyday clandestinity of acts and dreams. No problem bothers me as much as an issue I confront all day long. How can I invent a passion, fulfill a wish, or construct a dream in the daytime in the way my mind does spontaneously as I sleep? What haunts me are my unfinished actions, not the future of the human race, not the state of the world in the year 2000, not the future conditional, nor polishing up abstractions. If I write, it is not, as they say, for others, nor is it to be exorcised of others' demons. I string words together as a way of getting out of the well of isolation, because I need others to pull me out. I write out of impatience, and with impatience I am seeking to live without dead time. I want to know nothing of others save that which concerns me directly. Let them free themselves of me just as I free myself of them. We have a common project. But it is out of the question that the project of the whole human being should require individuals to be diminished. There are no gradations in castration. The apolitical violence of the younger generation and their contempt for the interchangeable goods on offer in the supermarkets of culture, art, and ideology are a concrete confirmation of the fact that individual fulfillment depends on the application of the principle of every man for himself, although this has to be understood in collective terms, and above all, in radical terms. At that stage in a piece of writing, where we used to look for explanations, I would like us from now on to find a settling of scores. I'm going to stop there, and I'm happy to take any questions, or was that... Is it...
Tell me, give a little bit of perspective why we asked you to come here and how you came to translate this and maybe the challenges in the translation. You were involved in some of these events back in the 60s.
Yes.
Maybe some of the challenges, again, the challenges of the translation, you know, how...
Yes.
When you're talking about ideas that are so abstract, how do you give meaning?
Yes. Well, I understand your question. You asked me two questions. I'll give you a bit of background of a personal kind. in the 60s, I was living in France, and I was a member of this same group that the author of this book was for a couple of years, and so he happens to be a lifelong friend of mine. So that's the first thing that relates, that connects me to this book, which is this, you know. The second thing is that in the years in the 70s, we several of us tried to translate this book into English, with the result that parts of it were published in the form of pamphlets in the United States and in the UK, and there was one attempt to publish the whole text. In those days, oh, thank you very much. In those days, no, what we used to call a bourgeois publisher would ever even dreamt of had the slightest interest in this whatsoever. So, all this publishing was spontaneous or pirate in some form or another.
What was the original language?
French. Because the man's Van Agem is a Belgian. The group was in basically this time more or less centered in Paris, although it was an international or would be international organization. In reality, it was principally active in Paris. What was I going to say? I think that.
Well, something about the translations.
Well, yes, I will. Let me address that. Yeah, no, I just had a little bit more to say about the genesis of the translation. No, actually, I'm happy standing.
No, to set your.
Oh, thank
coffee.
You. That's a good idea. Good. Thank you very much, Alan. So there was a lot of attempts to translate this in a very, you know, amateurish fashion, and in 1983, I published the first edition of this translation, but was really a cobbling together of everything that had been done by various individuals until that moment. And at the time, we were still interested in producing a text which would be what the French call a text for combat. In other words, it was an organizing tool, or at least an influencing tool, which would have an impact on. So we felt very free to depart from the strict original French, which is very literary in a way, and to add our own bits and bobs. which we did. I think we were right. I mean, but now, much later, we're talking about 25 years later. I came back to this. I thought, well, I'll just revise, just fix a few typos and give it to Ramsey and we'll publish it. And when I started to do it, I realized that it was not going to work, and that I really had to give the book a whole new weight with its true, so that it would resemble something like the French original, which is very literary, very beautifully written, and of course you can't do it perfectly, but I wanted to make it as nearly as possible a representation of that work with its literary dimension. As of you will have noticed, there are lots of, it quotes lots of authors and artists and references that everybody doesn't necessarily have at their fingertips. So you have to read the book. I mean, actually reading it aloud is not probably the perfect way to, you know, to receive it. I mean, you really have to read it. As you say, there's a lot, good deal of abstraction. It's very philosophical and so forth. So that's, the point's well taken. This isn't the ideal way to actually read the book. I mean, but it's a way to sort of perhaps at least present its existence to you. Now coming to the other question, the problems of translation. The problems of translation are, they're simply, in this book, the problems are that of the fact that the French have a belles-lettriste way of writing, which is very flowery. And, you know, if you want to make something that's a little bit readable, you still have to cull that a little bit. You can't really maintain the same degree of floweriness in English with this kind of rather poetic, come philosophical text. So there is a work in, which involves changing it to some degree, at least in making it more English. You know. So I would say that was one of the main problems, one of the main difficulties when I really tried to come closer to what the original was like. Because it is a very poetic work in a way, and certainly in his sense of poetic especially, which is a very broad definition of poetry, including basically insurrection and things like that. So, I mean, you know, that's part of it. I don't want to sound immodest, but basically I think I was well equipped to do this because I was familiar with the text from when it was written. So, I mean, and I'd also spent all that other time years ago trying to sort of get into some kind of English. So now I actually have to say that I'm pretty happy with the result. I mean, the book is a document of 19, as I say, over and over again. We must remember this was written 50 years ago in a different atmosphere, a different culture, and a different, of course, a different time. And I think the book is very prescient in its critique of modern society, but I mean, at the same time, it can't be just taken as is and applied to the world we live in today in any way, shape or form. I mean, all the political references have changed, you know, the conditions of the society of the spectacle which he's describing are still with us but much reinforced by the arrival of digitization, etc. So I mean, while it's very prescient, it simply can't be just taken and applied like a manual to any, it doesn't have any utility. But it is my hope that it will have we'll find readers, you know, among a younger generation. And his original title of the book was a sort of ironical or a pastiche of an 18th century title. He called it it's called the Traité de Savoir Vivre à l'usage des jeunes générations, which is a sort of pseudo 18th century title when people got self-help books, you know, for etiquette and so forth. It sounds like a manual of etiquette in its French title. It's not the revolution of everyday life. Although that title was chosen by, so not by me, but the book came to be known by that title, so I didn't want to change it. The French title means approximately manual of savoir vivre for young people recently established in the world.
The other way I've heard that frame is called Totality for Kids, right?
Totality for Kids is nothing to do with this book.
No, it's a separate.
It's the same author.
It's a
translation of another text of his called Basic Banalities. That's a literal translation of the French title, which was a short text and really programmatic in the sense in which I said before. It really was a programmatic. These are the books you should read. This is what you should think, etc., etc. So that's another text altogether. Yes, yeah. The Totality for Kids was a title made up by the Brits. Yeah.
But this was geared toward young people anyway, according to the title.
Exactly, that's
so
in the title.
It's really an educational test.
Well, yes, and obviously there's a... Absolutely, but of course there's a degree of irony and a sort of... It's also a kind of literary device to say this. Yeah. But it is also real. I mean, there is a real attempt to address younger generations. That's exactly what his intention was back in 65. Yeah.
So I wonder if you could set the framework for us maybe a little bit about what was happening inside of France, if not Paris itself, and set the not only the situation as international, but then what became May of 68, and how that would be slightly different than what we might consider of our sort of like common understanding of American history, which seems to sort of like forget that like 68 even happened.
Yes, well, the American 68 is different, obviously, from the French 68.
It's a much different
obviously,
so
there are tremendous connections, but I mean, nevertheless, it is a, you know, the context is radically different. France, I think, the thing to remember about France in 1968, say, is the fact that they had just been occupied for several years by the Nazis. They'd won, you know, they'd been liberated, and it was only 20 years later. So people, the generation who were just coming to... were, say, adolescent at the time of the liberation, but the people who fed into this movement as far as the French people were concerned. And it's also very anchored to its time in the sense that the critique of commodification and the arrival of consumer society was much more sudden in France, and experience is much more sudden because all of a sudden, about 1950, France was flooded with consumer goods, with appliances, with cars, none of which had been there before in any great, and suddenly they were thrust into a society of the American kind, which the Americans had already been used to, and it actually it came on America much more slowly. But because of the war, which had sort of slowed this thing down or even arrested any such development, the French were suddenly flooded with the culture of the consumer society, and there's no doubt that the situation and other people in France, I mean, I would think of Edgar Morin, Henri Lefebvre, quite a number of social critics were also reacting to the fact that this was so alien to French culture that they were really rebelling against just commodities, you know, in the simple sense of the word. I don't mean necessarily in the Marxist sense of the fetishism of the commodity, but just commodities that we're all used to. In America, this had been going on since, you know, the 20s or even before. I mean, you know, everything suddenly arrived in France like an immense invasion, you know, because suddenly the economy started to pick up and, all these contraptions, suddenly everybody had to have them. So there was a reaction against it. And I mean, it's certainly true that the critique of the consumer society was so radical at that time, precisely because of the suddenness with which all this cultural change had been imposed on the country. And I think that's very important to bear in mind and trying to contextualize it, as, you know, you were asking me to do a little bit. I would say also that it's very difficult for Americans, and I think, you know, to some extent also for Brits, really, to imagine what it's like to emerge from, you know, German occupation after all those years. And everybody, you know, France was a very... even in the 60s, you know, it was still in a very sort of delicate psychological frame of mind. I mean, they also had decolonization going on. They had the Algerian War, which was very, very... It was practically a civil war. They really almost had a civil war in 46, you know, after the liberation, when they had the right and the left almost came to blows, right? By the left, I mean the Communist Party. I mean, that case. You know, the communists and the right, or, you know. There was almost a sort of larval civil war. People don't remember this. I don't remember it, I wasn't there, but people have forgotten how near France came to civil war in the immediate wake of the liberation. You know, that was the time when everybody was, you know, dragging out anybody suspected of being a collaborator and shaving the women's heads and, you know, shooting a lot of people in summary executions. I don't have any numbers, but... So, you know, this was a little bit like maybe the Cultural Revolution in China or something. It was a very, very violent time after the war. Even after the war had finished, it was still a very violent. And the Algerian thing was obviously continued that feeling of living in a very violent political situation. So the place was nothing like America in the same day, nothing like it at all. America came out of the Second World War, obviously having lost a great deal, but also it was the GI Bill and everybody was just sort of, you know, the whole of the, you know, an enormous section of the proletariat was being, you know, elevated and getting a decent standard of living and being called middle class rather than working class.
Well, the war vastly improved the conditions of the working class here, because there were so many. There was the draft created that created the army and the GI Bill and all those things.
Yes.
But there was also lend lease even before that. You know, the
right. It's true.
The printing of money just to give it to the likes of Henry Kaiser to build ships and for Colt and Smith and Wesson to send bullets. You know, I mean, because there was
It was a boom. I mean, obviously, it was the end of the Depression. The war finished the Depression and. Some way. I mean, I agree.
But here, more so.
I mean,
there,
no. I mean here.
Because there was.
I mean here. I mean here.
Yeah. Because in Europe, there was a 30 years war. Really.
That's right. 15, yes. Exactly. The gap between the two wars is often, given too much weight. In fact, it was the Second World War was a continuation of the First. I mean, how many years is it between 1918 and 1939? Well, it's 20 years and no more, no less. Right. Yeah. That's not very long. 20 years. Right. It's not even really a generation. You know.
But here we saw even more westward expansion, more growth, and still to this day we're talking about still having being able to accommodate another 100 million immigrants here.
Yes.
You know, I just heard that discussed.
Yes. Well, that's why I say that the condition, the two countries are simply not. They can't easily be compared at all. I mean, they're radically different situations. You know, just to avoid the idea, well, they're all advanced capitalist countries and we can sort of lump them all together. It's not possible to understand very much if you do that.
Can you talk more about the language of revolution, what that means? When you translate it.
Can I say something, even though with this huge difference that you're saying between France and the United States, which is obviously clear?
Oh, well, I mean, I was really referring to the...
both countries,
I was referring to the conditions under which people arrived in 1968 were totally different.
But we were focusing on the differences, but there's also something else going on, isn't there?
Well, yes, apparently. I mean, there are people who believe there was a world revolution in 1968. Emmanuel Wallerstein believes this. I don't believe this for a second, but, I mean, he does. Then, in other words, there was some... So there was some movement or tendency which was perhaps even worldwide at this particular point in time. I don't personally believe that.
You don't think there's any shared experience?
Well, there's a lot of copycatting, people. There's also obviously cultural exchange, so that in point of fact people use the same codes, if you like, the same regalia, the same the same art forms, the same kind of fashions. In art and in everything else, but in point of fact, the cultures remain very, very, very different from each other. That's why I just believe in making the distinction rather than trying always to sort of lump things together. I don't think it helps us to understand that.
I wouldn't say it's an either or.
Yeah, well, all right.
Attempt to say it's an either or.
Okay, I agree. No, I don't disagree.
And there were certain things in Europe that we admired, and we still to this day admire. It was when folks stand out in London or in the streets of London or in Paris, and throughout the world. I mean, it's funny to worry about going out in the streets and protest here when we have really nothing to lose. I mean, we have probably more economic security here than many other countries do, and yet people in those other countries where they have so much more insecurity will take to the streets. But I wanted to ask you a question about the language of and maybe the psyche, the mind of revolution. When you translated this text and you had to, you said that there was some poetry involved. What is the language of revolution, and how does it translate?
You mean the terminology of revolution? Or do you mean the language of revolution?
Again, there's a lot of abstractions in the book.
Well, I mean, I would say this. I think it's possible to, if you sit and read it. I mean, you just sort of have a few elements of, reading a book of any philosophical book. I don't think it's particularly difficult. It might be difficult in some of the references being a bit obscure, although they are actually named. You can go and look them up and Wikipedia, so these days especially, right? So I don't think it's a problem. I resist the, you know, the kind of the idea of having an annotated edition explaining all the proper names, who they are, because I figure that now anybody can go and find out very easily. So it's much easier than it was before. So, but that's not really answering your question, but I'm not sure I understand your question. About the language of revolution.
When you talked about sacrifice, and
yes, well, from the text.
You
mean something? You're asking me, what does he mean? Or are you asking about the translation?
Yeah, I think there's a psychological, position that's taken, and that forces us to use certain words.
Yes.
And I'm thinking that maybe sometimes when you translate, maybe you see that there's two ways of, or more multiple ways of looking at things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's true. I mean, I'd go much further. I would say that you can't translate anything. I mean, in an absolute sense. And what I mean by that is, in a book like this, for example, you can't translate it without transforming it or allowing it to be transformed. So, you know, you can do your best, but you can't. I mean, it's a common illusion that somebody's writing a philosophical book or a political critique or whatever it is. It's an illusion that it has, that it can go into another language or another culture and be understood in the same way, because the other culture doesn't understand anything in the same way, right? Especially something suddenly transported in a. So as good as the translation will be, the other culture will transform it according to its own light. Now, the situation is international, or all people who want to make an international organization, and the French, I don't want to be anti-French particularly, but I mean, they have, since the Enlightenment, they really do believe that their ideas are universal. And in some sense, that may be true. I mean, the Americans obviously took much from the French Revolution. But, same time, everybody interprets these things according to their own ideas, and those ideas are unconscious in some sense. So you don't. Nobody can read this, have the same experience reading this book in English as they can in France. Maybe people imagine that they can, but they're in an error. So that's why I say that in fact it's impossible to translate something in the fullest sense at all. It's an impossibility. So therefore you have to work with the fact. If this is, this was a book which we tried to translate to encourage revolutionary activity, right, for example, or critical activity, and of course both. But, by the time it's crossed the channel to the UK or come over the Atlantic to the thing, no matter how closely, how competently you've represented it, it's going to be read in a different way. It's going to mean something else. Not totally different, but, very largely different. And this is why I've spent a lot of time thinking it's very difficult to do it. It's like you've given an impossible task. And it's doubly impossible if you're trying to belong to an international group that would like to sort of be, as they love to say, these people, coherent. You're supposed to be consistent wherever you are and whatever conditions you're confronting. That's insane, in my opinion. But nevertheless, that was what we were trying to do. So you probably do something, but it won't be exactly what you set out to do.
Thank you. Come back for a Q&A in about 10 minutes or so.
Okay.
Don't let yourself get stolen permanently by people buttonholing you. I'll drag you back here.
Oh, okay. I'll obey all orders and go.
But here's where we try to extract money from anyone who didn't give money when we sent out our fund appeal recently. We don't get money from anybody but you folks. So those things are empty and they're just aching to have things that Russell put into them. If you care to write a check to the Marxist School of Sacramento, it's tax deductible. And I'm sorry I didn't bring the coffee stuff because I'm not allowed to do heavy lifting this week.
But we didn't do it. We have cookies. We're going to be back here for questions and answers.
We will be back here for questions and answers, and I did bring cups for water if you want to walk back there and let the water run for about a year and a half. It'll run clear and possibly be drinkable. And please do come back in about 10 minutes. The bathroom's over there. And if you're not on our mailing list and you want to be on it, there's a sign up sheet. There are two scary restrooms and stuff there.
Yeah. Oh, Speaker to come back, and let's get started again. It's been about 12, 13 minutes now.
Thank you, Michael.
Yes.
Where did Ron go?
Did he go outside?
Or did he go back?
Okay. I'm sorry. I broke. Oh, there you are.
I'm here.
Yes, I'm calling you back.
Okay.
I think you may be.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm going to get a bit.
That's more. A recording that Seth is doing. So
I thought somebody left it.
Yeah. No. Much apartments just possibly impossible not to be organized. Huh? Oh no. Thank you.
about how many people were actually involved in the, how many people were involved in the Situationists when you were
about 12. It varied a little bit during the time that I was there. I think the low number was about 9 and the high about 15. So on average, this was the late 60s, before May 68, about 12, the average. And the organization dissolved itself in 1972. And there was a period of its entire existence which started in, maybe I better get this right, 57. Between 57 and 72, which was the length of the existence of this group, the total membership was 70.
And just real briefly, what, if you could just speak to the any communications or what if you could just describe briefly the international links that you have with other revolutionaries?
Yes, I can, yes. Broadly speaking, there was an attempt to be an international organization, so there were always a number of people in other countries, but basically I'd say, and certainly in the latter part of the group's existence, its center was France. But during the course of its existence, there were groups in Germany, England, Denmark, at the very end of the United States, and Belgium. And did I say Germany? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Germany. But these sort of extensions of the group were tended to be short-lived. It's very famously this group of they did a lot of expelling of people on principled grounds. So they were like the Surrealists in that we were continually expelling people as well. The idea being that you wanted to maintain some sort of consistency. So if people were not sort of, didn't seem to, you know, weren't on the same page, they were kicked out. Some of these expulsions were, you know, unfriendly, but many of them were friendly, you know, so it wasn't necessarily continual kind of animosities. But yeah, there were some that were a little bit brutal. Yeah. Yeah.
Did the Situationists gather or kind of ideology, or was it?
Yeah, they had their own. They would not have dared to. They would have hotly denied that it was an ideology because they understood ideology in a negative way, like many people, as a false set of ideas, you know, as opposed to a true set of ideas. So they would never have said that they had an ideology. That would have been, you know, to basically completely against their definition of that term. But nevertheless, they certainly did have a belief system and a program and certain themes and certain preoccupations. And they certainly defined themselves relative to other groups and other thinkers. And yes, I would say they were very much adhered to the idea that they had a defining philosophy or a scheme for action and so forth. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Was the group active during the events in 68?
Yes, they were.
What kind of actions?
Well, they were involved in the occupations in the Sorbonne and in the Paris, essentially. They had a very great success in the very beginning, and I think it has to be said that in the end they failed, simply because the whole movement failed, you know, to make a social revolution, I mean, you might say, to put it in a nutshell. But the nature of their success was that they were very influential in one strand of the occupation forces within the university, and that against the opposition of many of the small groupuscules, you know, meaning the Trotskyists and Maoists, etc., and various other small groups of communists, but dissident communists. I don't mean the PC. I don't mean the Communist Party. Left communists, whatever they were, against the advice or the orientation of many of those, they decided to call for a general strike. And they were largely instrumental in doing that, because it was considered to be adventurous to call for a general strike. But after they called for a general strike, you know, the small group of people in Paris University, a general strike occurred. So I would say that was quite a large success. It was the largest general strike in history.
Excuse me, I missed the part where the development of the general strike. Is this group in favor of a general strike?
Absolutely.
They were in favor.
They were in favor of occupying the factories immediately. And said so in various posters and declarations. And they were followed. Of course, perhaps you could say that these occupations of the factories would have occurred in any case, because it was a revolutionary moment in France. But in any case, when they called for it, before it happened, they were opposed by practically all the Trotskyites, and of course by the Communist Party, who already realized that there was a big problem, they had a big problem. And you probably know that by the end of the day, or the end of the month, perhaps you should say, the May 68 movement was defeated because the Communists did a deal with the state. The Communist Party, the official Communist Party. So that, although it was a very widely followed movement, even among workers, many, many, many thousands of workers followed the, and disobeyed the Communist Party in this moment and had a more revolutionary position.
So was the general strike, did the general strike have a leadership or any...
Well, no, because it was, you can't say it had a leadership, but it had... It was the workers that had the general strike, and I mean, they had their own leaders. And they were getting contrary orders from the real leadership, so they disobeyed their leaders.
Wow.
That's what happened. Because the Communist Party did not want a general strike. But they got one anyway. So, I mean, nobody can say that the Situationists caused the general strike. That would be silly. There were 10 people. I mean, you know, it doesn't make sense. Although the Bolsheviks were very few people also. But anyway, that's another story. I mean... But I feel they should have done better. But they, you know, they did actually were very instrumental in precipitating the general strike and the most militant few days of the month of May in 1968. Yes, so I would say they had a great deal of success. Perhaps in some ways they did. In some ways, I feel, and this is just my opinion, that they failed to, shall we say, figure out how to assume leadership of the position of the student movement, which was very volatile, and they were very concerned to disappear into a general movement, because that their theory said that they should disappear into the general movement. They should not assume a vanguard position, or in no case should they become a political party. Well, yeah, of course it's a lot like Occupy, yeah. Yeah.
Which leads to my question, what comparisons would you make between Days of Rage, or maybe the day, some, you know, the movement there in May 68,
right,
and Occupy Wall Street?
Well, I haven't thought about it very much. I mean, to say, I think anybody can try to figure out their own parallels. I mean, obviously, these are times of, you know, I mean, obviously, the French situation was much more revolutionary than the Occupy moment. I mean, by any standard, right? I mean, it's just not. It's apples and oranges, right, in that degree. But there's definitely parallels in terms of the forms of action and the forms of disobedience of leaders. I mean, if we were anarchists, we would think that was the best thing that could happen. But I mean, yeah, I think there are parallels, definitely, definitely. I mean, just anecdotally, the Occupy movement, I mean, this, of course, is not something that, it's trivial, but the Occupy movement was actually sparked by a post-Situationist group, you know, Adbusters, who basically took their inspiration from the Situationist International. They were the ones who initially ordered the demand that Wall Street be occupied. It came from Adbusters in Canada, right? They were the ones who had the idea. Everybody said it was ridiculous. How could you occupy Wall Street? But they actually did occupy Wall Street.
Right.
So,
from his ad campaign, an anti-ad.
Well, yeah, Adbusters is an anti-ad. Perhaps you know what it is. Right?
That's,
right.
I have a question. You were saying that Germany, France, et cetera, et cetera, are all part of this international, you said that for freedom, the USA was also, and that they eventually kind of fell away from it.
I didn't say anything about falling away. No, I didn't say anything about falling away. I said there was briefly what was called a section, a U.S. section of the Situations International in the United States.
How did it manifest itself? What events manifested that here?
I don't know about events. They published one issue of a Situationist journal, and they published pamphlets. They were involved in a lot of agitation in New York City. And of course, they also had many followers after the disappearance of the formal disappearance of the organization. After 72, in other words, there were a lot of people who followed Situationist ideas and tried to form, as it were, neo-situationist groups, especially out here in California. There was a large number, throughout the several years after 72, there was a lot of what would you call them? And there was no longer a Situationist International, but they modeled their activity on the Situationist practices, or praxis, if you want to call it, praxis. So I don't know if that answers your question. There was briefly, within the Situationist International, an American section comprised of, I think, four people.
That's it?
Do you want to know who they were?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. No, I don't think so.
They're
people that I would know, but not you.
What's a situationalist anyway? What's a post-situationalist? I really woke up.
Well, it's not a situationalist, it's a situationist.
Situationist?
Yes.
And what's a post-situationist?
Well, post is somebody that comes after.
Oh. In fact, that's post a lot of things. San Andrews is a post-mugwump.
Yes.
Post.
Well, maybe there are post mugwumpers.
Possibly. But so what's a situationist?
A situationist is a member of the Situationist International,
You're not allowed to do that.
I'm not? No, I'm saying this seriously. In other words, it was a group that gave itself a name and formed itself in 1957 and called itself the Situationist International and proceeded to act as a group until 1972.
So it doesn't really mean anything? I mean, I'm taking some medication
it doesn't mean anything. But except that the name does have a history.
Okay.
Right? So the original founders of this group were anti-artists, you could say, right? Who had a theory which involved creating situations. And that is the origin of the name. Creating situations meant experimenting in a way with everyday life and in a kind of surrealist manner, because the surrealists did similar things. Try to create moments of privileged experience for people involved in the experiment, if you like. And that was what creating situations was originally. It didn't amount to very much, but it was. That's the origin of the name. And then because they had this activity, they called themselves situationists for want of a better name, and it stuck. So I'm not fooling when I say it doesn't have a great deal of meaning, but it does have an origin. I mean, it has a history. The name has a history. But that is
not a deep philosophy.
No, sir.
Like
No, not at all. No, it's not a deep word. No, not at all.
So it's more related to performance art, something that you alone.
Yes, this is something like that. Yes, something of that order. Yes, because they were artists to begin with, and they were into conceptual art, and they were very opposed to obviously the art market, etc., etc., just like people might be today. But they were anti-artists, as the Dada used to call themselves. That similar. That was the origin of the group. But before long, they started doing a lot of thinking and theorizing, and gathered in a certain number of people who were not actually artists, but amateur philosophers or or political activists, you might say, in a sense, right? Something like that. Just to, so that it became a rather more varied group.
When you say anti-art, you mean anti-commercial art?
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah, the same thing with writing. There were groups of writers that formed the Little Coalition, you know, and had these group gatherings where they would discuss, you know, these kinds of things, and they tried to create
situations.
Situations and experiences. Yeah,
precisely.
For each other.
Right.
But, so you probably see it all through life, with all different kinds of groups. This is just one particular group.
Yes. Yeah, and this is right. No, I agree. Yeah. It's true. So the thing didn't last very long, but it went through some changes. An evolution with the, of its nature. The group changed its nature to some degree. I mean, that's fair to say. And, you know, this book and the other one, which is public, was written by Guy Debord, were the two major written statements of the positions of this group. Although the books are very, very different in nature. The other one is far more abstract, actually. Tell me, talking about abstract.
I have a question about what happened with the World Trade Organization, the anti-WTO in Seattle, the ballot from Seattle in 1999, and some of the other anti-institutional protests that happened right around that time. I remember we had the agricultural ministers of the world came to Sacramento. We had they hired every unemployed person who could be a cop and put them in riot gear, and they surrounded the Capitol, they surrounded the convention center where they were holding the meetings, they surrounded the parks, the state police came out. I mean, it was a real show of force. And yet, there was a huge, huge outpouring of media. And I wanted to ask you, in France, when during the Days of Rage, and maybe other times when you have seen the actions of the media, how did they perform? How did you, obviously these are different times. 13, 14 years ago, the media was able to set up satellite links so that they could get out indie media, digitized news. And, people were using small handheld cameras and shooting all the stuff that was going on, whether it was in Seattle or Sacramento. Was there anything parallel to that in the media in France in 68? How did the story get out?
Well, the media were obviously very much present, and they were, everybody was trying to manipulate the media one way or another, both sides. You know, I don't know if I have any anecdotal things to tell you about what exactly happened, but I suppose, I don't know, actually. I think I have to say I don't know.
Were there situationists?
I mean, the situationists were not, there was, and various other similar, you know, like-minded people, mounted an amazing assault on the media by occupying the main radio station of France completely, the ORTF, by occupying the main big theater, which was in the middle of Paris, and they held it, turned it into a general assembly, by occupying, as we said before, many buildings of the university, and by occupying the Fine Arts School of Paris, very eminent institution, and turning it into a workshop for producing posters, which those posters are very famous and emblematic of May 68. But it was done by seizing control of the studios of the Beaux-Arts, which is the Fine Arts School of Paris. So, in the sense, those are attempts to sort of produce a counter-media. And there was a lot of counter-media. And I don't know if that was what you were asking. In terms of what the mainstream media did, I don't really have very much to say. I think they did what they usually would do, which support the state. I mean, I don't think that, I don't know, I have nothing very sort of significant to say about that. Of course, they didn't report the things that they didn't like, and they reported, they told you what the police were doing, I don't think there's much anything very significant. But, you know, there was the media people went, the reporters and people, everybody in the country went on strike, you know, including footballers, you know, I mean, by which I mean soccer players. They had a big soccer strike. Everybody went on strike. It was really a general strike. And it had a strong cultural dimension because it was about really demanding a total change in society. So I think it was a revolution, but it, of course, a revolution that ultimately failed. So I just think it was a revolution, a revolution situation at the very least. And people forget that they talk about the students or the hippies or whatever. I mean, they don't talk about this was there was a workers' revolution in France in 1968. And I don't think it was that gentleman's gone, but somebody said they thought it was part of a world movement, and I don't think it was. I think it was the French doing their thing, you know, which is they build barricades and they have revolution every now and again. You know, they've invented it, practically.
How much do you think that the war with in Algeria had to...
Well, don't forget, the war in Algeria was actually drawing it over, really. But this was the background to the growth of these events. And the war in Algeria was a very traumatic period for the French state, and once again it was very close to being in the early 60s a civil war with a military coup and everything like that. All the big buildings in Paris had you know, the army were on the roofs, you know, with machine guns, and they were ready for everything. This was a very, very, but it was before 68. It was considerably before, right? It was in the early 60s, right? So it was over in one sense, but all these, everybody knew, everybody, I mean, Algeria was the main political issue for several years in France. And it nearly came to a military coup, very, very close, by those who wanted to hang on to Algeria, the army, especially the secret army.
Remind me, was there a military draft during the France-Algerian?
Yes. And a lot of people have found good ways of getting out of it. But it wasn't easy. It was hard to get out of it. Yeah. Absolutely. And it was, yeah, that's, I mean, of course that was part of it, you know.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes, yeah. But not in May 68. I mean, right. May 68 came later. But, you know, I mean, that was the context from which it issued forth, you know. So I think you'd have to remember the Algeria situation. It has to be part of the background, right? Most people were very surprised by May 68. Nobody was really expecting it. The situationists said they were expecting it, but they were lying. They said, this is what we said was going to happen. We forecast it. Or if they didn't say we created it, they at least said we forecast it. And they really didn't. Mm-hmm. Except they said, you know, our ideas are in everybody's head. You know, that was what they said famously, right? So that people said you're theorists and, you know, you're intellectuals and you're just you're just covering sheets of paper with little black marks. But they said, well, our ideas are in everybody's heads even if they don't read our stuff. And I mean, that turned out to be somewhat true. Should I say? But I really think it's important that people want to understand the May 68 that they study the French situation a little bit rather than to draw parallels. I mean, I probably exaggerate. I mean, there probably were more connections with 68 in America but I think it's important to sort of apply a countervailing idea that these countries all had their own story, not that it was all part of a worldwide upsurge, you know. There are certain people who say, for example, that because of 66, 67 was the Cultural Revolution in China, they say it's all part of the same thing. But this is absolute nonsense. And on top of which, the Cultural Revolution in China was a reactionary time. It was not a revolutionary time. So, I mean, I just don't think, you know, it should be connected. A lot of people in the West idealized the Chinese Cultural Revolution, and they tried to imagine that China was building socialism, but it wasn't. It wasn't. It was made up. It wasn't true.
But there was uprising. There were student uprisings in Mexico at the same time.
Yes, well, I grant you.
Right.
And in Mexico, you know, you had other conditions. But of course, the culture of the time was the same. Everybody was listening to the same music, and everybody was trying to follow the same fashions. And in Mexico, they were modeling themselves on the French students who were so militant, etc. No question about it. So I said there's a lot of copycatting, but you know, nothing really changed the fact that in each country, the conditions were very different. In France, in Mexico City, just before those Olympics, they shot 300 students dead in the street, right, at the Tlatelolco Square, right, in 1968. Yeah, but it was a lot of students who were just slain and thrown from helicopters into the sea. Nothing like that happened in France. I mean, there were very few fatalities in 1968, but the situation was very revolutionary. In Mexico, the situation wasn't really revolutionary, but the students were very revolutionary, and they acted like 68ers. They wanted to be like, you know, and you know, they had plenty of things to complain about. You know, I mean, they were right. I mean, but they were put down with an amazing alacrity.
Well, the way that would play out would vary from place to place, but there was turmoil in a lot of places.
Well, but what are you suggesting that? Listen, Ellen, are you suggesting that somehow there was some sort of, you know, vibe in the atmosphere? What was causing things to happen simultaneously? You had civil war in Ceylon, I mean, Sri Lanka, right? That wasn't connected. People, oh, it's that 68, it's that 68 thing. But it's not true. I mean, there were different conditions, different things. And besides, what was happening in many places was a disaster. Even from a revolutionary point of view, it was a disaster.
Well, all the post-colonial stuff in the former colonies wasn't too happy.
No, I agree. I just don't want to simplify things. I mean, that's what I'm trying to...
No, but there were global things happening that maybe had repercussions that manifested themselves in different ways in different countries, but...
But what were they?
Still made it... Well, the end of the colonial era.
No, well, that was the general context. We can't... Of course, it has to be said. I don't know. I don't have a theory. I just believe in trying to sort of not... Oh, it's just my own preference. I don't believe in trying to understand things by jumbling things together because they happened at the same time. You know, some historians, they say, well, this is, we're now looking at 1947, and then there was such and such a film was written, such and such a novel occurred, such and such a statesman was assassinated, and these things are all now supposed to be connected. They're not connected.
It's because of microbes on meteorites. They come down.
Well, that's my first choice.
In fact,
yeah, sunspots.
We had a question.
Sunspots. Remember the sunspots?
Sunspots.
Yeah. I know, that was
just... I'm really glad that I left.
I didn't know he left. Yeah.
So how long were you in France and why were you there?
Well, I was about 20 years old. I was just a kid, you know. I went there after I dropped out of school. So I lived there just because I wanted to. I mean, I didn't have any ambition. I still don't have very much ambition. I didn't want to work, I knew that.
I take it you're English?
You're correct, yeah.
England? That's
yeah.
Like
yeah. English, yeah.
So you dropped out of school in England?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
What was it like in England? Among the students and intelligentsia during the French general strike?
We were trying to copy them in England. We were trying to copy them. We didn't do very well.
Why
not? Well, I mean, we just weren't able to gather ourselves together, I don't think. We were definitely, you know, did lots of great things. We had a lot of fun, you know, in 1968 in England. I was in London mostly in 1968.
What would you say the basic difference was, or might have been, between conditions in England? Kind of that the French Revolution, or virtual revolution, then we're in the United States, the 1968 was a time of war and lots of the marches and stuff like that, the center of all activity and the civil rights movement. There's nothing like that, but we think that England would have been a little closer to the French situation with the
passage in the Second World War and the labor socialist regime in Bosnia, similar economy.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, it's a very good point. I mean, I agree with you that it's not easy to analyze. And I mean, to your point, Alan, I would say there were parallels, of course. You know, I don't say there are no parallels or no common things, but I mean, basically, England was in a very different place in 1968 to France. It was, but, you know, we were having our own revolution of a sort, you know, swinging London and, you know, all this sort of... And, you know, there were groups doing similar things in terms of direct action and, you know, all kinds of artistic or anti-artistic provocation was going on, you know, and there was a lot of... but it's not... never developed into a workers' movement or a general strike, not even close, nowhere near. Trouble happened later in England. But in 68, there was a lot of cultural revolution, you might say, to coin a phrase. There was a lot of scandals and provocations, and you know, on the cultural front. And you know, obviously, there was a lot of admiration for the French events among the younger people. Definitely.
It's interesting that that the activities of dissent throughout the world at that time had the aspect of the Cultural Revolution and the political economic revolution.
Yes, well, I mean, I don't have the same analysis of China as you do, as that would imply, but certainly cultural revolution was abroad, and it's what I call copycatting, and you know, people were following the same fashions. You know, it was the beginning of a sort of global culture. You know, media in media terms, and we were listening to the same, you know, records and things like this. So certainly, yes, there are obviously parallels, and. And the Vietnam War was very important both in France and in England at that time. It certainly was a catalyst of an immense amount of mobilization in both countries. You know, and it was a major theme in 68 in France, the opposition to the Vietnam War. And those groups which had formed around, you know, solidarity with, you know, the Vietnamese and anti-Americanism that followed upon that logically. And in England too, we had immense demonstrations against the American presence in Vietnam. Of course, it was also the British presence, but the Americans obviously were the major presence there. The manifestations or the demonstrations against the American embassy were very, very, very violent, very, very big in London. It was called the Grosvenor Square demonstration. Was in a day, and one of the biggest demonstrations that I think I ever remember in London. You know, certainly in recent times, when they surrounded the American embassy and there were many injuries and many cops sent to the hospital, and it was a big riot and a demonstration both. So, you know, one shouldn't underestimate the importance of the Vietnam War. Very, very big in Europe at that time. And in all these different situations, yeah, very big. Obviously not like the States, but nevertheless. And that was like that was something that everybody had in common. They were against Americans in Vietnam, and in favor of the, you know, the Vietnamese. So yes, that's true.
It was an anti-imperialist.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. But I mean, specifically regarding Vietnam, I mean, many of the biggest demonstrations concerned Vietnam. They weren't general anti-imperialist. I mean, people had the theories of anti-imperialism, of course, were there and mobilizing themselves and others, but the fact is, the cause of the demonstrations was Vietnam.
But ironically, the French preceded the U.S. in Korea.
Yeah, but the French had been, you know, set packing.
Yeah, exactly. So what was the reaction? I'm not familiar with what happened in France. Of course, it was after the Second World War,
Well, what happened in France was, I mean, you know, in terms of Vietnam, I mean, the most significant thing was that the Communist Party basically didn't detach itself from the French imperialism. It didn't oppose it. maybe mildly verbally, but it didn't really oppose those colonial wars until very, very late in the day. So opposition had to therefore fell on the heads or on the shoulders of people to the left of the Communist Party, because the Communist Party just did whatever Moscow said. I mean, naturally.
You have a very low opinion of the Communist Party.
Yes, I do. I mean, I think they prevented revolution in 68, for one thing. I mean, at least they did everything they could to stop it, and it did, it probably other forces stopped it as well. But certainly I have a low opinion of the Communist Party, certainly. And I mean, I think that's also true in other places. I mean, in England, this, to go to your point about the difference, we had no Communist Party really of any consequence in England at all. In France and Italy, it was like a major party, you know, tremendous power. The English Communist Party didn't have any power. They had a few people infiltrated into Labour. You know, they talked a lot, but they didn't have any power. Right? I mean, so it's vastly different to, say, Italy or France. Totally different. The configuration of the political parties, you know, it's quite different. And, it's, you know, people underestimate the difference, especially, I think, from the States. People see Europe as like one place. I mean, that's silly. You know? I mean, there wouldn't have been any Second World War if Europe was one place. Those wars were about Europe, right?
Now it's one place.
Well, it's trying to be, right?
Yes. It's working really great.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the reason is why they have it is because of they were so frightened by World War II. I mean, that's why there is such a push to have a united Europe in capitalist terms, right? Of course, it's a capitalist united Europe. It's not a socialist, you know, adventure, you know, but it's nevertheless, it's an attempt to stave off what happened in World War II. I mean, that's very consciously the object of the exercise. And some people forget how important it is. Not, I mean, but Yugoslavia, look, they almost went back to Second World War. They started, you know, locking people up and starving them to death and massacring them and all the rest of it. Because they forgot about, you know, and Europe didn't step in and fix it. I mean, I'm just getting into my own opinions now. We're very far afield from the, you know, I'm no authority on these matters whatsoever, right? I'm just trying to translate this book.
Yeah. Ask you about the Totality title that you mentioned earlier.
Totality for kids, yeah.
For kids. Can you talk a little bit more about Rowell's other writings, maybe include that in it?
I didn't understand.
Is anything else he's written?
All right. Well, yes.
For his authorship.
He's written about 20, well, yes, you can. Oh. This is not his greatest work, but this is like a thing you wrote very quickly, a pamphlet describing the relationship between the Situationists and the Surrealists, right? And I think I said before that Aladier was the most Surrealist of the Situationists. Situationists spent a lot of time defining themselves in contrast to the Surrealist movement, which was already gone, because they wanted to be more consistent on the political front. They wanted to be more radical politically than they reckoned the Surrealists had been.
Are you including the Surrealists and Dadaists?
No, I'm not, because the Dadaists really preceded the Surrealists, and one came after the other. I mean, not that there's a great deal of connection, but I'm talking about the Surrealists now. So this little book was like also by Van Agem, which I translated some time ago. And, you know, you can get one if you want. I mean, it's very... it has some great quotes. I don't think it's such a great book, really, but, you know, it's a readable. It's very readable.
Great quotes are always good.
There are really great quotes in it, you know. He quotes people a lot. And he really has a great ability to find great quotes. So, and of course, he knows this stuff back to front, right? I mean, he really knows what he's talking about. But it's a slight book in some ways. It's got no, it's not, can't be really compared with this kind of magnum opus, which is the book that I was reading from before. So I would just say, you know, read it. I mean, I think it's a lot of fun, but you'd learn a lot about the Surrealists. And, I mean, for what it's worth, that's all. I mean, here, if you want. It's called The Cavalier History of Surrealism.
So how many books have you written?
He's written about 20. Most of them have not been translated. And with Ramsey, we're going to translate a few more, if ever we have, if, you know, if the Lord provides.
the manners. so is Rubel a contemporary of yours?
You know, he's about 10 years older than me.
Oh, okay.
And, yes, and maybe even a bit more. He's, in other words, he's in his 80s.
Okay.
And he's an old fogey. Yeah.
And what's he doing now?
He's doing much the same as ever. He's writing a lot, and he lives still in Belgium, which is his home country. And I think he's working on some book with a very famous French cartoonist called Sampé, and they're doing some kind of text plus cartoons. I don't know. They're cooking something up.
That's Sampé that does the cartoons for the New York.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's it.
Has his work been translated into other languages?
Yes, many. Yes. The Anglos, and, you know, meaning both Brits and Americans, is very slow to translate things. I mean, I'm very slow, but I don't mean it in that sense. Things don't get translated as much as they should. That's what I mean.
In your reading, though, seem to be the themes of life and death and sacrifice.
Yeah, well, there was in that passage, yes, that's true. He was trying to describe basically fascism and the fascist philosophy, specifically Nazi philosophy. And that was what it was mostly concerned with. You know, the cult of death among in the Nazi philosophy. And trying to sort of, I think, give a kind of existential account of what it was to be a Nazi. I mean, a fully ideological Nazi. And what was the psychology of it to some degree? He's talking about that. I mean, obviously, that has been addressed by other people. Quite interestingly.
Sacrifice was also related to that.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
He was
saying that sacrifice is always, you know, shall we say, anti-revolutionary.
And it's now, I think, 9 o'clock, so that we could spend another 2 hours, but we can't, on the discussion of the parallels between that and revolutionaries who are revolutionary.
Who?
Sacrifice revolutionaries. Left-wing revolutionaries just sacrificing themselves for the higher causes.
Well, yes, well, he's criticizing the idea that that is a necessary thing. I mean, obviously, it's somewhat, I mean, I don't know, it's up to everybody to make their own choice. But I think that, you know, this was the, he considers that his book is starts from the position of a subjective position. You know, he says this all the time. It's called subjectivity, and he says that really everything starts with the individual. You know, and he apologizes in a sense for this and says, but I'm doing this because nobody else does. So I'm sorry that I'm going to be, everything's going to be based on the subjective. He said, let other people work on the objective things, but I'm going to be subjective. And that's the sort of poetic conceit of the whole book, really, that everything is approached from the point of view of one's own subjectivity. I mean, this is a basic theme, yeah. Do I have any? Well, I think, you know, no, not except that obviously there is a rise. I mean, it's somewhat
successful, or you see them as more successful?
Well, they're not taking power, are they?
No,
that's what they would like to do. So, you know, we're still in the sort of neoliberal, you know, world. I mean, the right-wing parties in Germany and France, I mean, they're not taking over. For the moment, I mean, I think they have to be, I think they're the enemy. I mean, of course, absolutely, but I don't have any. I don't know how significant it is in the big picture. Do you? I mean, do you think it's very scary? I mean,
if you have a picture of how significant they are.
Well, I mean, I'm living over here. I don't know, you know, I'm not really in the thick of it. But, I mean, you know, everybody's scared by the right-wing parties in Europe. I mean, I think we have a right to be scared by them, you know. We saw what they did when they did take power, right? So, you know, you have to fight them, I mean, in every way. But, I mean, that's all that I could say, really.
Well,
Well, with friends on the left as we have now, you know, in terms of the not right wing, it seems to me that we're with the austerity measures being imposed by moderates and the left, you know,
Yeah,
it seems like we're kind of just being petty.
Yes, well, the austerity idea is, you know, really winning the day, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, even from a capitalist point of view, it's not such a great idea. And I mean, they don't look out for themselves either, really. They, you know, they're looking for short term.
Yeah.
And their main object is to redistribute wealth upwards, you know, and increase inequality. I mean, that's what's going on. I mean, people don't want to see it. There it is, and it's plain as day.
Good. That's a good place to stop.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yes. And thank you all, and all of you who remain, go buy all those books, so Ramsey doesn't have to take them all the way back to the Bay Area.